once at the beginning.
Okay. So let's just summarize. First of all, for those who have Sfarim, so we're up to the Ma'amar Rishon, again, still in the first essay, the first chapter. And we had gotten through last time the paragraph Chaf Hei, that's paragraph 25. Just to sum up, last time we saw that the Jew, the Rav, the Chaver, began presenting his arguments to the king of the Khazars. And unlike the philosopher, the Christian, and the Muslim who had gone previously, all of a sudden the Jew's arguments began to resonate, which is a good thing, because most of the rest of the book, all of the rest of the book, is all about the Jew and the king of the Khazars having the conversation. Otherwise we probably wouldn't be studying it, right? So the arguments begin to resonate. And essentially the first point which the Rav makes in his discussion with the king of the Khazars is that our belief in God comes not from abstract philosophy, it comes from experience. And to really have this relationship with God, it's a relationship which is born out of our personal experience, and only really tangentially out of philosophic contemplation. So the big proof to that idea that Rabbi Yehuda Alevi, again speaking through the mouth of the Chavir, the Rav, you know, in the Kuzari, the big proof that he brings to that idea is the very way in which God reveals himself to the Jewish people at Har Sinai. When God opens up the Ten Commandments, the Aseres HaDibros, so he says, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am the Lord your God, Asher Hotseisicha Me'aretz Mitzrayim Yibeis Avodim, I took you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. So says Rabbi Yehuda Alevi, you know, you would think that God would say, I am God who created the heaven and earth, because after all, you know, in terms of the various projects which God has taken on, the creation in heaven and earth would seem to be much more fundamental. In other words, if you were laying down the religion, somebody came to you and said, you know, tell me something about Judaism, I know nothing about Judaism, you would think that the starting point would be God created the universe. But no, that's not the way in which God presents himself, because God's creating the universe, says Rabbi Yehuda Alevi, is for us basically an abstraction. I mean, you know, we weren't there. You know, how do we know that God created the universe? Well, I mean, besides the testimony of the Torah, you know, the only way that someone could come to that realization is through philosophic speculation. In other words, well, you know, what was known in philosophy throughout the ages is the argument from design. I mean, the world is so organized, the world is so put together, there must have been a creator. Right? So logic, reason dictates that there must have been some kind of force who created the world. Yeah, that's correct. We believe in that. But that's not religion that we can experience. The only thing that we can say that we know through personal experience is that God took us out of Egypt. Right? In other words, the generation that received the Torah had been direct beneficiaries of, you know, God taking them out of Egypt and performing all of those miracles. So that was the way in which they experienced God. And, you know, that, and only that, Rabbi Yehuda Alevi says again and again and again, can be the basis of our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Right? So again, this is, we pointed out last time that this is typical of Rabbi Yehuda Alevi, that one of his constant themes is he's extremely anti-philosophy, right? Because philosophy came from a totally different point of view. Philosophy said, no, it's about what you can reason, what you can figure out from logic. If anything, your experience can lead you astray. I mean, a real philosopher would say that your experience is all subjective. You know, if you want quote-unquote objective truth, you have to be able to demonstrate it, you know, the way that we used to do geometric proofs, you know, back in 10th grade, you know, with 1, 2, 3, 4, or we tried anyway, you know, and then QED at the bottom, and, you know, you feel like you actually did something and maybe you got it right for the test. But, you know, if you can prove God in that way, that's significant, a philosopher would say. But experience, no, experience doesn't really cut it. Yehuda Alevi was totally opposed to that. It's only experience, and philosophic speculation is only going to get you so far. We pointed out also last time that even within the Rishonim, you know, the medieval greats, there was, you know, tremendous disagreement with the position of Rabbi Yehuda Alevi. And we quoted just one very specific opposing view, was that of the Ibn Ezra, Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra, who we pointed out was related somehow to Rabbi Yehuda Alevi. in his commentary to the beginning of Aseres HaDibros, the Ibn Ezra writes, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi asked me the question, why does it say, Anochi Hashem Elokecha Asher Hotzeisicha Me'eretz Mitzrayim? I'm the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt. Why doesn't it say that I'm the Lord your God who created the world? In other words, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, I guess before he wrote the Kuzari, was contemplating and thinking about this question, and he asked the Ibn Ezra. And the Ibn Ezra says, so I told Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi as follows. The Pasuk is really speaking to two different distinct groups of people. To the intellectuals who are able to arrive at the concept of God through speculation, the Pasuk says, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am the Lord your God. Right? Because really that means, you know, I am Hashem that you can, you know, that you can contemplate and that you can derive the concept of God from looking out at the world around us, contemplating how beautifully designed the world is, and mimela you'll come to a belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And for the Hamonam, for the regular people, for the Hoi Poloi, who aren't capable of reaching that level of philosophic speculation, they need experience in order to bring them to God. So the second half of the Pasuk addresses those people and it says, Asher od seisicha me'eretz Mitzrayim, that I took you out of Egypt. So what for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is the highest level of being able to come to God, the concept of personal experience, for the Ibn Ezra, that's for the Poshita people, for the simple people who aren't able to engage in the kind of rational philosophic speculation which would bring them to an appreciation of God on their own as the creator. So two very different perspectives, both legitimate perspectives within Yiddishkeit, as to the role of speculation and the role that experience plays.
But Rashi agrees with Yehuda HaLevi.
Which Rashi?
Rashi there? On the first pasuk on this.
What, Anochi Hashem Elokecha?
This
Kedaihu Yitzias Mitzrayim, that Rashi. That, you know, Yitzias Mitzrayim would have been enough.
Also because
right. Because it's a machayev. In other words, now that I took you out, now you have to, you know, you're bound.
Yeah, you won't say that you are, we are listing, we are...
Well, that's the Rashi, the very beginning of Bereishis, that Rashi. But there is a Rashi in Shmos. Right there on that Pasuk, which, of course, would be in the Chumash, which is not right in front of me, but...
I'll
take any Chumash
with Rashi. Bereishit.
There is another Rashi on Anochi Hashem Elokecha where Rashi says some kind of lashon like Kedaihi Yetzias Mitzrayim. You know, that the exodus from Egypt was enough to obligate you to follow me. I'm not sure, but it's possible to read that like Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. It's possible to read that like Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. All right, so we'll get the exact...
So he didn't say...
I don't know
how he paskin in terms of that. Thank you. I don't know if it's shy if the paskin and such a thing. What's Rashi on Shmos? So Rashi writes...
Say that the people shouldn't say listim atem.
But that's Rashi, the very beginning of Bereishis. That
right,
Rashi.
Yeah.
Rashi over here, right? Rashi
about the gamkens.
Asher od seisicha me'eretz Mitzrayim, kedai hi ha'hotza'a shetiu meshubadim li. Rashi writes that the exodus from Egypt is sufficient cause for you, the Jewish people, to feel obligated towards me. Right? So again, it's not exactly Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, but in other words, it is a stress on the idea of the Exodus, because that's what creates the special relationship we have with God, not the creation of the world. And again, it could be that Rashi
is
hinting at that idea.
This is our relationship
right.
with God.
Yeah. Right.
And Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi expresses that the fact that there were so many nisim, this is why you have to accept Hashem.
Mm-hmm.
But and the nisim were actually done to us, so we are obligated to it.
Right.
But b'davar acher, Abraham, it says Abraham Avinu brought half of humanity under Kanfei HaShrina.
Right.
Velo minisim, but through
contemplation.
Through contemplation. Right. Right. But what happened?
Right. They all left.
That nothing was left.
They all left.
Which means right. that the majority of human people cannot conceive right. of without Hashem without something mm-hmm. which is right. substance.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
I want to know what would Rabbi Yehuda already say about somebody who was intellectual and did come to a realization of God's greatness through his intellect? Would that be a lesser form of belief than the experiential?
I think he would say that in the end of the day, you're lacking something if you don't have that experiential. You know, it's hard to say because even, you know, once we've had the experience as a nation, it's almost like we automatically have that experiential element. I mean, when we talk about the experiential element, it doesn't mean, you know, like, you know, that I personally experienced it. No, it was like God came to me in a dream, you know, and told me to do this, that, or the other thing. Right? When we talk about the experiential element, it's the experience of the nation, of Klal Yisrael, which at this point, by definition, we all have. So even a guy tells you, I came to God through philosophical speculation, what he really means is that he was able to confirm through philosophy that which his experience already told him.
Let's say like Avraham Avinu.
Right.
He came to the realization that Hashem, you know, is God, not because he went out of Egypt, but because, you know...
Right.
Because he looked around and...
Right.
So
actually, Rabbi Sennheffler referred to that, and again, we'll see that a little bit later on in the Kuzari mm-hmm. itself. Avraham Avinu originally comes to God through his own speculation. Looking and in fact, he makes Talmidim. Mm-hmm. The Rambam, by the way, writes mm-hmm. in the beginning of Hilchos Avodah Zarah, you know, we always talk about the nefesh asher asu b'charon, right? Avram and Sarah yeah. going out, being Megayer people. So how many people did they convert to this early kind of monotheism? So you kind of think, okay, he was really successful. 20 people, 30 people, 40 people. The Rambam writes, it's an unbelievable thing. I don't know where the Rambam got it from. The Rambam writes, they converted thousands and tens of thousands of people. Alofim v'rivavos. Where'd they all fit? How'd they all dab together? Oh my gosh, you know, I mean, what kind of besmetish did he have? Right? But thousands and tens of thousands of people, the Rambam writes, and all of these converts to that early form of Judaism, whatever you want to call it exactly, they all fall off the radar screen. We don't hear about them afterwards.
So apparently,
right, apparently they're that philosophically driven religion didn't stick. Again, you know, we'll see, but, you know, from the point of view of the Kuzari, what really distinguishes Avraham Avinu and makes him cling to God is God's revelation to Avraham Avinu. I mean, witness the fact that from the Chumash, again, we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, but in Chumash, we don't find any discussion of Avraham Avinu's soul-searching and his odyssey, his journey to discover God. God just kind of pops up in the beginning of Lech Lecha and says, "Well, Shalom Aleichem, Avraham Avinu, it's a pleasure to meet you. By the way, just leave Charan and go to Eretz Yisrael if you don't mind." Right? And all of these stories which we would expect the Torah to tell us, you know, all the stories we know from the Midrashim, that he went out and he saw the building that was illuminated, and he said, you know, there must be a creator, and he smashed the idols and they threw him into the furnace. So all these things, you know, that you would think, like when the biography came out, you know, that would be all the juicy stuff, right, in the beginning of his life. The Torah doesn't bother telling us about that. I mean, it gives us the impression, like Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, all that matters from the Torah's perspective is once God reveals himself to Avraham Avinu and he has that divine experience, as opposed to the divine which he discovers through his own contemplation. That apparently pales in comparison. I mean, you can't say it's insignificant, right? But it pales in comparison to when he ultimately meets up with God through revelation. So this raises a question. This brings us to Chav Vav. That's all kind of a summary of last time. But this raises a question. The question actually was raised here in the class last time. So Omar Akuzari, right? So the Chavir, the Rav, gives this Chav Vav, right? The Chavir, the Rav, gives this very beautiful description of how our belief in God is rooted in experience and not in abstract philosophy. And specifically, the national experience of the Jewish people. You know, the miracles we experienced in Egypt, you know, the giving of the Torah at Har Sinai. Omar Akuzari, Im Kain Ani Roesh Shetorachem Eino Nesuna Kein Lochem. So then what you mean to say is you have a very particularistic religion. In other words, as opposed to the religion of the philosophers, or the point of view of the philosophers, where because it's not rooted in experience, anybody can join. Your Jewish religion is all about the things that you went through as Jews.
That's true.
So, therefore, someone who didn't go through those things, meaning someone who's not part of the nation that went through these things, doesn't really have any connection to the religion. Because you're not really a universal religion then. You're a religion for a very distinct group of people. Ve'en chayav bo zulaschem. And nobody besides you really is obligated in this religion.
No.
Right?
So
that's strange. That's very strange when you think about it. Again, we're used to it because we're Jewish, right? And that's the way we look at the world. Okay. But, you know, if you think about it in terms of religions of the world, you know, most other systems of thought or religion want everyone in the world to embrace this point of view.
And the Jewish because, does not.
Because this is truth that's for everybody.
We are not missionaries.
Oh, so, but that idea, says the Rav, and this it comes out in the discussion between the Rav and the Kuzari, that idea makes sense to a much greater extent if you go with Rabbi Yehuda Alevi's understanding that our commitment to the Jewish religion is based in our experience. So, Amar Achaveh, the Rav answers, Kainhu, you're right. You hit it on the head. V'chol anilva eleinu min ha'umos bifrat, yagienu min ha'tova, asher yetiv ha'borei eleinu, ach lo yihyeh shove imanu. Here we'll introduce something. This is a major theme of Rabbi Yehuda Alevi and a very controversial one. But we'll bring it out over here. He starts bringing it out. You should know that really, first of all, you know, you're right. The Jewish religion is a religion that's for the Jewish people, the nation that experienced these things. And really, it doesn't purport that other people from other nations are obligated in some way in all of this system of mitzvahs, because after all, we don't believe that that's true. And again, as was pointed out, we don't missionize. We're not trying to convince the entire world to join the Jewish people. We do believe that anyone who, any non-Jew who joins up with us, Hanilva Eleinu, we believe that Yagienu min Atova Sheyetiv Abore Eleinu, that God will reward that person who joins the dictates of the Jewish people properly. Achlo Yeshova Imanu, but he's not going to be totally equal to us. Right? Now, this can refer to two things. This will refer to two things. This can refer to two things. And again, I think both of them are true with Rabbi Yehuda Alevi, and both of them require talking about a little bit. When the Kuzari writes, L'chol ha'nilva eleinu min ha'umos bifrat, anyone who joins us, who accompanies us, from the nations of the world. What is that talking about? So there are two possibilities.
Convert.
One obvious possibility is a convert, right? The other possibility, which is less obvious but may work a little bit better with something later in the phrase, is a non-Jew who chooses to observe certain aspects of Torah, right? Who chooses to observe certain mitzvahs. We're not talking about the Shiva mitzvahs B'nai Noah. We're talking about, let's say, a non-Jew decides that he or she wants to keep kosher. Right, kashrus is a beautiful thing. It's a wonderful idea. You know, I'm not interested in being Jewish, but I would like to keep the laws of kashrus. Right, so in that case, let's just start with that case, and that's what we'll see that may actually fit the words a little bit better. Is a non-Jew allowed to keep mitzvahs? Other than the Shiva mitzvahs B'nai Noach. If a non-Jew says I want to keep kosher, if a non-Jew says that I want to keep other kinds of mitzvahs or things like that. So one thing which we find specifically, the Gemara says, a non-Jew is not supposed to keep Shabbos. Right? Even people studying for conversion, until they actually get to the point where they convert and they're practicing keeping Shabbos, but there's supposed to be one aspect of Shabbos every week which they intentionally violate, because Shabbos is supposed to be a unique relationship between God and the Jewish people. when it comes to other mitzvahs, in other words, let's say it's not Shabbos, let's say, you know, the person says, you know, I'd like to keep kashrus. It sounds like from the Rambam that other mitzvahs besides Shabbos that the non-Jew chooses to accept upon himself, he might have the ability to do that. You know, let's say he chooses to keep kosher, right? He knows, I'm not Jewish, I understand, I'm not obligated to keep kosher, but nonetheless, I'd like to keep the laws of kashrus because I find them meaningful to me. They say a sizable portion of the kosher market, quote-unquote, in America, something like 80%, is not Orthodox Jews. So a good portion of that, obviously, is Jews who are not Orthodox, but there's also a very sizable percent of that market who are people who are not Jewish altogether and just buy kosher because they think, rightly or wrongly, you know, they think that it's healthier, it's better, it's gooder, higher authority. Right? Yeah, okay, but you know, there's a very, very substantial portion of people who are non-Jewish who are out there, you know, buying kosher food. So it could be that what Rabbi Yehuda Levi is saying is that he has no obligation to do this because he's not Jewish. The Torah, you know, let's say the mitzvah of kashrus was commanded to Jews. However, he will get a reward for keeping kosher. It's not a silly thing for him to do. It's not a foolish thing for him to do. But that reward can't be compared to the reward which is given to Jews. Why? Because it's a principle which the Talmud lays down. Gadol ha-mitzvah ve'osa, mimisha eino mitzvah ve'osa. Meaning, it's on a higher level to do something out of a sense of obligation than to do something out of a sense of volunteerism. That's a general, that's a principle, and it applies actually to many of the people, most of the people sitting right here in the room, right? There are many mitzvahs which women are not obligated in, but nonetheless choose to accept upon themselves. A classic example is the blowing of shofar on Rosh Hashanah, right? I don't want to burst anybody's bubble, but there's no strict commandment. The commandment to hear shofar on Rosh Hashanah, strictly speaking, is oriented towards men, not towards women. For centuries, women have chosen to fulfill the mitzvah of hearing shofar on Rosh Hashanah, and it's meritorious to do so. But again, you know, it's in the category of a voluntary mitzvah, right? And as such, according to halacha, you know, the reward for performing an obligatory mitzvah is considered to be higher than the reward for performing a voluntary mitzvah. Why is that? I mean, that's very counterintuitive to a lot of people, because after all, if I volunteer, so, you know, it should be better. So I'll give you the classic answer, and then I'll give you a little bit of a contemporary twist on the classic answer, which, I mean, for me, brings it home tremendously. The classic answer, which the Bali Taisvus write, is that, look, if you're obligated, you have to contend with the Yetzer Hara. You have to contend with the evil obligation. Do it, you know, wake up in the morning. No, I don't want to wake up in the morning. Wake up in the morning, Shacharis is 6 o'clock. No, I don't want to wake up in the morning. Forget about it, what are you telling me about, right? You know, when you do something out of a sense of volunteerism, so the Yetzer Hara isn't working because, you know, you're not obligated to do it. So, you know, it's just a lot easier to do it out of a sense of volunteerism than out of a sense of obligation. The contemporary twist, which, again, I've come to appreciate in my own life, and I think it's true as well, you know, why is it that the Torah values to a much greater extent, you know, the mitzvah which is done out of a sense of obligation than the mitzvah which is done out of a sense of volunteerism? Well, just consider what happens in public life. You know, you have a lot of wonderful, talented volunteers who can get involved in a project. But in the end of the day, if you want the project done, you usually have to pay somebody to do it. I mean, that's just, them's the facts of life, yeah, right? I mean, that's how it works. You know, if you want something done, in the end of the day, you know, hiring somebody to do it and saying you are now obligated to carry out this task will actually happen. You know, volunteers are good and it's wonderful and it's good to volunteer, but at a certain point, you know, volunteerism can only be stretched so far before it breaks. So the same is true in Torah and mitzvahs as well. You know, there's a value to volunteering to do mitzvahs, but in the end of the day, if the buck doesn't stop there, you know, it can't be held to the same kind of standard that we would hold somebody who's obligated to do the mitzvah. Yeah, yeah? Okay. Can draw straws for it, I guess. Who's that?
Do men get like higher olam haba because they have, you know, some, it seems like they have create so many more obligations for the non-responsible store.
So, I'm going to turn off the tape for this. Right.
I guess she
asked. Just before I answer that, I have the plexiglass, scale. Which is going to come down in front. Yeah, the question was, you know, let's take the gender out of it for a minute. Are people who are obligated to do mitzvahs, did they receive a greater olam haba than people who do mitzvahs out of a sense of volunteerism? There is a position which is associated with a couple of contemporary rabbonim. I know Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, advocated this point of view, and I think it precedes him as well, that the fact that men have certain extra mitzvahs which women lack, you know, talis, tefillin, kriyashmak, tkishayfa, you know, all these sort of things, you know, stems from the fact that there's a certain innate spirituality which women have, which men have to work harder in order to capture. So if that's the case, so in a sense, men are playing catch-up to women, you know, in terms of that. So in other words, you know, it's not that, well, you're going to have more mitzvahs, so therefore, automatically, it means a greater olam haba. It means by doing these mitzvahs, you know, the men, let's say, are bringing themselves up to the point where the women are currently holding.
I'd say too.
Okay. Okay. That was good. All right, Shekaya.
We get what we get. You know, we're still not going to stop. You know what I'm saying?
Right. No. But the truth is, I mean, again, in all seriousness, if you start from that point of view, that the giving of extra mitzvahs to men, you know, the mitzvahs esei shazman grama, you know, those positive time-bound commandments, is to fill some kind of spiritual void which women naturally possess, which men lack, you know, so then it would stand to reason that in the corresponding schar, the women already have a certain madrega in Olam Haba, which, you know, the men are playing catch-up with in terms of the mitzvahs. The very interesting news articles that appeared in the, you know, the Jewish newspapers in the past year or two. So, as is well known, the non-Orthodox movements have essentially erased any kind of gender differences whatsoever between men and women. So, in the past couple of years, they've been faced with a tremendous problem, quote-unquote. Men don't come to temple. You know, I don't know if that's such a terrible problem from our perspective. Okay, but, you know, they created a situation where the entire religion, you know, there's absolutely no difference between men and women. So, Mimela, they have a very difficult time getting the men to come, because we all know, you know, it's the women who are driven by the spiritual forces, by spiritual drives. You know, it's very interesting to note, in the world of conversion, you know, the proportion of women converting to men converting to Judaism is like 90-10. I mean, it's extraordinarily lopsided, you know, and I think the reason for that is, you know, just among other things, but I think one of the reasons is that women out there in society tend to be more spiritual, more drawn to things which are religious, and if anything, in Yiddishkeit, by providing men with so many, you know, explicit mitzvahs which are unique to them, Judaism is trying to preserve a certain sense of balance. The women we know are going to be spiritual. The men need a little bit help in terms of being spiritual. So I read, you know, the paper about a year or two ago, the Reform Movement came up with this incredible new idea in order to address the fact that, you know, that only the women are coming to temple and the men are not. They had this idea, maybe we should start services just for men. You know, we can make it into a boys' club, and if we make it into a boys' club, a men's club, you know, so then, you know, that way the men are going to feel empowered, they can come, you know. They don't even have a mechitza. I mean, it's mamash, it's frumer than we would be, you know. I mean, the women are not even allowed into the room. I was like, some of the shtiblach, you know. So, you know, they thought by doing this, they can somehow restore that sense of balance which they had eradicated without even thinking about it by taking away any gender differences whatsoever, you know, between men and women in, you know, their reforming of Judaism. So again, you know, if one works with that perspective, which I think is empirically borne out, you know, that there's a certain innate spirituality that women have. So l'chara, you know, we are playing, we the men are playing catch up, you know, to a large extent. What's that?
That managed to get very spiritual, like Rashi, Ezra, you know, Malbim, all the people that wrote it.
So that, just coming back to the Kuzari for a minute. So again, one way of interpreting the words of the Chaver is that a non-Jew who stays a non-Jew but chooses to perform mitzvahs, hanilva eleinu, he attaches himself to us, not by conversion, but just by virtue of doing mitzvahs. So he'll get a reward, but it won't be quite on the same reward, on the same level as what we the Jews are getting, because he's doing these mitzvahs out of a sense of volunteerism, as opposed to out of a sense of obligation. The other way to read the Kuzari, which is more controversial and is also more unique to Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, is to say that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is talking about confidence. Yes, Judaism is primarily meant for those people who are biologically part of the Jewish nation. Converts can join us, and indeed, if they do join us, they will receive much of the good which is promised to the Jewish people. But a convert is not going to quite be on the same spiritual level as someone who biologically is considered to be Jewish.
You mean a ger tzaddik?
Yeah, a ger tzaddik. That's exactly what we're talking about. A ger, a giyaras, right? Now, this is an idea which Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is going to spell out more so in the remainder part of the Sefer, and it's one of the more controversial ideas that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi held of. And we should point out that, you know, it is definitely not shared by everyone, by all of the Rishonim. Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi was of the perspective, again we'll see, that much of what makes the Jewish people special can be described really in genetic terms. The Jewish people are unique and have a special kedusha which is associated with them genetically. Yes, it is possible to convert, but the convert is never quite going to achieve what a Jew from birth is going to be able to achieve. So what does that mean? I mean, just in very, very practical terms, what does it mean? So it doesn't mean as much as we might think. I mean, essentially the one area that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi says would be in the realm of a Jew from birth but is off limits to a convert is the realm of prophecy. He writes that, you know, the whole concept of prophecy, of nevuah, is something which is so special that only a Jew from birth would be able to experience that. Someone who is non-Jewish from birth but joins the Jewish people afterwards can reach very, very high levels of spirituality, but prophecy is always going to be something which is off limits.
Beyond.
So just one or two comments on that, because that, you know, again, people read that. Again, here we've just encountered it for the first time. We're going to encounter this a number of times as Rabbi Yehuda lays out a theory of of the specialness of the Jewish people, which is very, very genetic based. You know, somebody reads that in 2009, almost 2010, and you know the one word that comes to mind is racism. Oh, that's racist. Mm-hmm. You know, how could Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi make such a statement? You know, to say that because you're born into a certain group gives you certain innate qualities which somebody from the outside is never going to be able to achieve, you know, that, you know, again, especially in the beginning of the 21st century, after much of the things that the Jews have gone through during the 20th century, is a concept that gives a lot of people willies and butterflies, you know, to say the least. So just a couple of comments on that, and then, you know, I'll just try to deal with some of the questions. Just 2 seconds. So, first of all, it's important to note that not everybody was of the same mind with Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi on this issue. So, I mean, just specifically in terms of the idea of prophecy, the Rambam, in one of his Igaros, in one of his letters, specifically writes that Nevuah is something which can be achieved in theory by anyone who reaches a very high level of ruchnius, of spirituality. And the Rambam writes explicitly whether they're Jewish or not. You know, certainly, even a non-Jew in theory could reach the level of Nevuah. Bilam happens to be the example, but Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, I think, would counter, yeah, but Bilam was a very special case, and as Rashi himself indicates on Chumash, the prophecy that was granted to Bilam was kind of like a response to the claim of the nations of the world, you didn't give us a Navi. If you would have given us a Navi, you know, we would have fallen into line just like those Jews. Okay, you want Nevuah, I'll throw Nevuah at Bilam. But as a matter of course, it seems from that Rashi that God doesn't go around you know, giving prophecy certainly to non-Jews, and again, according to Rabbi Yehuda Levi, even to people converted to Judaism. The Rambam disagrees with that flat out. The Rambam, in one of his Igaros, writes, doesn't make a difference. And again, we don't get, you know, it's hard to argue from omission, but we don't get the impression from many passages in the Rambam that he really drew any distinction whatsoever between someone who was biologically born Jewish versus somebody who converted to Judaism. So that's Aleph. Okay, so not everybody agrees with Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, but Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is one of the Rishonim. I mean, it still sits a little bit uncomfortable, you know, to have Rabbi Yehuda Halevi drawing distinctions between people who, you know, are biologically Jewish versus people who come to Judaism by choice. So I think that there's a yesod, a basic concept, which I heard from one of my Rebbe, Rav Meir Twersky Shlita, which relates to the whole difference between Jews and non-Jews from a Jewish perspective. And I think, you know, he wasn't saying in the context of converts, but I think his remarks are equally applicable to, you know, the Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's the perspective on converts and how, you know, they can reach very, very high levels, but, you know, that super level at the top of prophecy is something which is off limits to them. I'm sorry?
They don't reach it.
They don't reach it. Okay, but how does one make one's peace with that? So Rabbi Tursky once expressed that we do find in various Rishonim, Achronim, and the like, the point of view expressed that, you know, the Kedusha, the sanctity, which is associated with Jews, is on a higher level than that associated with non-Jews. Some Svarim put that in very, very strong terms. You know, that the Neshama, again, and this is probably consistent with what we see in Rabbi Yehuda Halevi later on in the Kuzari, that the Neshama of the Jew is qualitatively different than the Neshama of the non-Jew, that there's a certain, you know, it's not just that we do more mitzvahs, but there's a certain qualitative difference. So Rabbi Twersky said, you know, you have to remember whenever encountering those statements that if one assigns to people who are not Jewish a lower level of existence, if one, so to speak, looks down at them, it's not such a tremendous madrega to be Jewish. The concept of the Jew being infused with a special Kedushas Yisrael derives its importance from the fact that we see every human being as infused with a special character just by virtue of their being human, right? In other words, you treat every human being, you know, Jewish or otherwise, with the special dignity which is afforded a human being just by virtue of their being human. In other words, you know, everyone is a notch up over, you know, the rest of creation, the animal and vegetable world. And then just we believe, you know, again, according to those Svarim that assign a special quality to the Neshama of Jews, that Jews are able to achieve even a higher spiritual level than the rest of humanity, who nonetheless possess the dignity associated with human beings. You know, what characterizes racist ideologies, you know, throughout history is that when they divide mankind into the, you know, the superhumans and the subhumans, they see the subhumans as being on the madrega of animals. You know, when the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, when they spoke about the Jews as being, you know, not the master race, you know, the Aryans were the master race and the Jews were this kind of inferior race, they basically equated Jews with animals. And in many cases, worse than animals. I mean, they treated animals, you know, as is well known. One of the first things that the Nazis did when they came into power in Germany is they outlawed Shechita because of cruelty to animals. Right? Which, you know, again, that took place, if I'm not mistaken, I think in 35 in Germany, right? So, I mean, you look back, you know, a decade later, 1945, you say, I mean, you know, what exactly does that say, that the, you know, one of the first edicts that was put into place under Hitler's regime in Germany was the outlawing of Shechita because it lacked, you know, it wasn't humane to animals, you know, I mean, it's, there isn't even anything to say to that, but, you know, the concept of, you know, the distinguishing aspect of racist ideologies has always been to look at the people who are considered to be subhuman, and to look at them in exactly that way. They're subhuman, they're less than human beings. They're like animals, they're worse than animals, right? I mean, all the signs that you know, in the South, you know, during the first part of the 20th century, you know, blacks and dogs, you know, are put together in the same sentence. Or in certain parts of the country, Jews and dogs, you know, are put together in the same sentence. You know, that's racism, and that has no place in Judaism, not according to the Rambam, not according to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi either. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is saying every human being is a human being, has to be treated with dignity, has a certain, you know, whatever we attach to the dignity of a human being is true of each and every single person, and a person who converts to Judaism achieves a tremendous madrega, you know, a tremendous, tremendous level of spirituality and holiness and the like. There's this one very high rung of spirituality and holiness, which is called prophecy, which according to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is restricted to people who have, you know, this certain prophecy gene, so to speak. I'm a mashal ma'adav v'dome. I happen to be myself, I think, a very nice and capable and wonderful individual. There are certain genetic things that will make sure that I'll probably never become a professional basketball player. I'm still not sure exactly what they are. You know, I applied for the Yeshiva University basketball team. Somehow, you know, I don't exactly understand why the guy burst into laughing, you know, into laughter at the time. But, okay, you know, some of those things are just genetic, you know. I mean, okay, there are certain things which are off limits to people because of genes. The Chiddush of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is there is a certain, call it a prophecy gene, you know, a very high spirituality gene, which is restricted to people who have that gene biologically. It doesn't, I mean, Chas v'Shalom, for in a moment, it doesn't mean that if you don't have that gene, that somehow you're knocked down to an inferior position, you know, where you're subhuman chalil or anything like that. It just means that you don't have that gene to enable you to achieve the ultimate prophecy. So again, just to sum up what we said, you know, this position of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, that there are certain levels of spirituality that the convert won't be able to achieve, is not universally agreed upon. And even within Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, it's very, very important not to confuse that with the kind of racist ideologies which have existed and continue to exist throughout history. You know, what characterizes a racist ideology is the denigrating of certain humans to a subhuman position. Here, everyone has a human position. Everyone is accorded the dignity which is accorded to human beings. Just certain people are able to rise to a superhuman type of level, which puts them above and beyond, you know, the dignity which would be accorded to a normal human being. Okay, so that was my presentation. I figured I'd get that all out, you know, before the questions, and if, you know, come back to the questions which seem to have been raised before. Yeah.
We do learn from many Galen, there were many prominent, they
right.
had children were very prominent, mm-hmm.
right.
even from Haman.
Right.
David HaMelech.
Right.
At the same time, we're also told we're not supposed to mention that someone's a gayer.
Right.
We're not supposed to
what
do
about
this.
You?
Right.
And restrictions we have among ourselves. A lady's not a Kohen, and a Kohen
right.
is a Yisrael's not a Kohen, and what
right.
a Kohen can do, a Yisrael can't do.
Right.
We can't judge. I mean, Hashem makes the judgments on the Neshama.
Right. No, 100%.
So these restrictions exist even among us.
Right. And Ochinami, it's, you know, which again is the ultimate answer to the question. You know, the Gemara tells a story about a, just along those lines, the Gemara in Shabbos tells a story about a certain person who wanted to convert. So he came to Hillel HaZaken, right? There's another famous story of the person who came to Hillel HaZaken, convert me while I'm standing on one foot, right? But so after that story, the Gemara tells another story. A person came to Hillel HaZaken and he said, I want to convert, Hillel the Elder. He said, I want to convert, I just have one condition. After I convert, I want to become the Kohen Gadol. I want to become the High Priest. So instead of saying, sir, why don't you go down the road, leave me alone, I just want to sit and say my shir and, you know, not bother anybody. Hillel said, okay, I'll take you as a student and we'll study. And, you know, I hear your conditions, but, you know, we'll talk about that. You know, we'll you know, that will be lesson 45, you know, that we'll get to in our pre-conversion study process. So they sit down and learn. And apparently Hillel had a very intense conversion program. They started at the beginning of Sefer Bereishis, and they just went through and translated. So they go through Sefer Bereishis, Sefer Shmos, Sefer Vayikra. By the way, this wouldn't be a bad curriculum for anybody, right? They get through Sefer Bamidbar, and the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar, they come across the pasuk where it says, anyone who's not a Kohen by birth even a Jew by birth, who's not a Kohen, who tries to do the avodah, to do the sacrificial service, is punishable by death. So this potential convert is sitting, and you know, by now he's into Sefer Bamidbar, so he knows his stuff. You know, he's translating, he's reading Rashi. I don't know, whatever he's doing. You know, and he turns to Hillel and he says, you know, that's a funny thing we learned just now. So that would kind of preclude me from being a Kohen Gadol after I convert, wouldn't it? So Hillel strokes his beard for a minute and says, yeah, you know, I never thought of that. Funny that you should mention that. I think that, yeah, that's actually a good point. I think that actually would preclude you. Funny thing, yeah, you know, we had this condition. Oh, well, you know, yeah, I had this condition. I was thinking about it. But, you know, I mean, it's such a beautiful religion, such a beautiful Torah you have. You know what? I'll convert even without the Kohen Gadol stipulation. Okay, yeah. Sign here on the dotted line. You know, just, you know, finish the rest of Bamidbar Dvarim and you know, we're set to go. Right? So, again, it seems like the back and forth in that story is precisely this point. You know, that potential convert thought, you know, the world should be my oyster. Right? Why can't I come to Judaism and, you know, be all that you can be? I mean, why can't I make it to the ultimate rung and, you know, achieve everything? Why can't I be a Kohen Gadol? And basically the lesson that Hillel said back to him is exactly your point. Yeah, but within Judaism, you know, not everybody has the same role. That's the way it works. That's the way the Ribbono Shel Olam planned our system. And that's what he wants from us, you know. And that realization apparently, you know, was the final thing that this potential convert needed in order to, you know, to give him a proper perspective on what Yiddishkeit is all about.
And that same goes for men and women.
And the same goes for men and women, 100%. Yeah. He was ultra Svaradi. What do I mean? He was ultra Svaradi? He was from Spain. Doesn't get more Svaradi than that.
This is ideology.
Right, that's...
And did he come after Yosef Karo or before
Yosef? No, he's way before Rav Yosef Karo. Rav Yosef Karo, first of all, was Israeli. Okay. So Rav Yosef Karo he grew up in Spain originally, but the family was forced to flee. And most of his time he spent living in Tzfas. If you go today to Tzfas, there's a beautiful shul, the Beis Yosef shul, Rav Yosef Karo's shul. So, but Rav Yosef Karo lived in the 1500s, so he's approximately 500 years after Rav Yehuda HaLevi.
So was he influenced by Rav
Yehuda HaLevi's ideology? That's an interesting question. Why do you say Rav Yosef Karo more so than anybody else?
Because he studied a little bit in Rav Yosef Karo.
Yeah. Rav Amar, yeah.
They have that edict of five rabbis
Oh, okay. So this is probably a much bigger issue than we can talk about in the 30 seconds over here. But I don't think it's a primarily. I don't think the issue of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is something that falls along ethnic lines. In other words, I don't think that his Sephardiness, you know, plays a role in terms of, you know, his point of view. I mean, again, witness the fact that Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra, who's also as Sephardi as they come, he's also from Sfarad.
Look at the time of the century and look at what's going on.
But they're contemporaries. I'm saying they're contemporaries.
Okay.
And again, you know, have very different points of view. And the Rambam, who's also a Sfaradi, right? I mean, starts off life in Spain and, you know, just makes his way to Egypt eventually. But I mean, you know,
just
still...
Yeah. Has a
yeah, but I'm.
I could be born Sephardi, but I don't believe anything.
That's right, right. I'm reluctant in general to assign people hashkafas based on ethnicity. You know, I don't know that it's fair or correct to say that there's a quote unquote Sephardi hashkafa versus a quote unquote Ashkenazi hashkafa. I think, you know, there are.
Very clearly, there is. Ashkenazim accept converts.
Well, Lav Davka, I mean, just let me with regard to that, and again, it's bigger than what we have today. The Syrian community in particular, right, but not all Sfaradim. I mean, there are plenty of, I know people, plenty of people who are Sfaradim, who are not Syrians, and, you know, have married converts and the like. Additionally, the Syrian reluctance to accept converts is a relatively recent thing. It's not something that goes back for generations. I mean, only to the extent to which, you know, the whole concept of many people converting to Judaism is a more recent one, because, I mean, till very recently, you're really taking your life into your hands to convert to Judaism. And, you know, I mean, people did, but, you know, the frequency with which people convert to Judaism today is is a function of the fact that we have a much more open society and a much greater acceptance of Jews, you know, than existed for centuries. I don't know. I would be very hesitant labeling it a Sfaradi versus an Ashkenazi thing. You know, again, the Syrian community has a particular, made a particular decision not to accept converts, again, for reasons that are really, A, unique to the Syrian community, B, fairly recent. You know, it's not something that goes back generations. The fact that Rav Amar in Eretz Yisrael is particularly involved in conversions, I think, is just because he wants to be particularly involved in conversions. I don't think that there's a... Yeah, but right. But I mean, again, if you really want to pull out all the Sfaradi Rabbanim, so Rav Uziel, you know, going back a couple of generations, was probably one of the biggest Mekilim, you know, one of the most lenient Rabbanim when it came to, you know, the standards, you know, at which converts would be accepted. And he was somebody who's as Sfaradi as it comes. I think it's hard and somewhat, you know, misleading to pigeonhole people based on their ethnicity, because what ends up happening is you stuff them into a box even before they got the chance to open their mouths and, you know, put forward a position. Oh, well, he's a Sfaradi, so he must be in this camp, and he's an Ashkenazi, so he must be in that camp. And you end up, you know, people lose the ability to actually express an opinion. You know, before the man opened his mouth, you already shoved him into the box into which he belongs. So, as I would be careful of doing that, just in general, because... it's better to analyze the position rather than, you know, the person or the background of the person who's putting forward the position. Al-Koponim. So that's the position of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. Again, it gets mentioned perhaps for the first time here. Again, it depends how you read this line. Gets mentioned perhaps for the first time here, you know, the notion of the biology of the Jewish people and what that means. And again, it's a concept we're going to come back to again and again. Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi was particularly, you know, enamored of this concept. V'ilu hayo chiyuv ha-Torah b'nei shibra'anu hayashove bo'ko b'nei Adam ha-lovon v'ha-shachar ki-ako b'ri-yosef. By the way, well, this is a very anti-racist remark that he makes. Says Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, had our obligation from Torah stemmed from the fact that God created us, you know, not that God took us out of Egypt, but had it stemmed from the fact that God created us, you're right, Judaism would be a universal religion which would be incumbent upon everyone. And we would believe in missionizing, and we would believe in making as many people Jewish as possible, because the Jewish religion would stem from God's having created us. So, I mean, everyone's equal. It would be equal to everyone. Halavon v'hashachar, white and black alike, right? Ki akol b'riyosef, because after all, everyone is a creation of God, whether you're white or you're black. But that's what I said before, you know, the Yehuda HaLevi is not a racist. Ach anu chayovim ba b'nei shehotzionu mimitzrayim v'hischabrus kevodo eleinu. But the reason that we're obligated in Torah, says Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, is because of our unique Jewish experiences. The fact that God took us out of Egypt and that he revealed his glory to us at Har Sinai. B'nei she'anachnu haskula mibnei Adam, because we the Jewish people have been chosen from all of mankind, that gives us a unique relationship, but it also makes Judaism the unique religion of the Jews, which we don't feel the need to share with the rest of the nations of the world. Now, by the way, the king of the Khazars did get his feathers ruffled a little bit with this very strong declaration of Jewish pride, and he answers in Chof Ches, Omar Akuzari, Aniroa Oscha Mishapech Yehudi. By the way, you Jew, I see you backsliding from your original statements. You started off very good, but now with this last statement, I'm not sure I like you so much anymore. Ukvar Shav Dibur Choroze, Ache Shahoya Shomeng. Your original words were very rich in content, and now they seem to be thinning out. Right? Amar Achaver, we'll just do the next two short paragraphs. Amar Achaver, not paragraphs, lines, I don't want to get you scared. Says the Rav, Ben Raza Ben Shaman, Harchev Libilibcha, Shafari Shosa. Okay, whether you think it's rich or thin, do me a favor, just let me talk so I can explain what I have to say. Omer Akuzari, Emor Mashatirtsa. Okay, say whatever you want. I'm listening, I'm not throwing you out, but you'd better make it good. So we'll pick up next week, Be'ezus Hashem, where we'll try to hear where the Chavir, where the Rav, tries to make it good enough that the Kuzari, is ready to keep listening to what he has to say.
You know that some people say that the Jewish